You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we can't always avoid angry people in our lives, but we can do something to avoid explosive interactions with them. We'll talk with UW Green Bay's Ryan Martin, also known as the Anger Professor, about some of the roots of anger and strategies for dealing with these situations. Now, the ways we get to know our favorite athletes are changing. Back in the day, if you wanted to learn more about the players scoring your team's touchdowns, home runs, and jump shots, you had to wait for a reporter to sit down with the athlete and write up a newspaper feature or a television package. Or wait for a quick biography to come out about your favorite player, as I once did with Detroit Tigers pitcher Mark the Bird Fidrich. More recently, though, players have started taking the storytelling process into their own hands instead of relying on traditional media platforms. It offers the potential for more unfiltered access into players' lives and personalities, but some media critics say it can feel more like public relations than fully objective truth-telling. Olivia Hancock is a co-founder and head of operations for Buy Us Media, a new athlete-driven storytelling company. And Chris Borland is a former All-American linebacker for the Wisconsin Badgers, also a co-founder of Buy Us Media. I talked to them last month. Chris, as a former player yourself, what has you so interested in creating platforms for athletes, in this case at the college level, to share their stories directly with the public?
Well, I think one of the overarching themes in sports over the last decade plus has been athlete empowerment. I think you've seen it with Naomi Osaki and other athletes kind of owning their narrative and sharing their story from their perspective. In my experience, I think while playing at Wisconsin and the NFL and afterwards, sometimes, you know, coverage was filtered through the opinion or perspective of the journalist that was writing the story. What's neat now, I think, particularly with young athletes, Gen Z and college athletes, is that they're content creators. They're used to putting out their story. I'd worked at the Players Tribune and saw some of the good that they could do there. And what Olivia and I want to create is a platform where athletes can speak directly to the public on what's important to them, what their experience is like. And I think really importantly to Olivia, it's easy to put your story out there by yourself, but we want to create a community where athletes can share their story with fellow athletes across the country. There's almost 500,000 college athletes that compete under the NCAA banner. So there's no shortage of incredible stories out there, and we want to create the platform where athletes can share theirs.
And Olivia, with all that in mind, can you tell us what it is that Buy Us Media is doing?
Yeah, so Buy Us is going to be a platform that empowers college athletes to share their story in their own words. We're primarily focused on stories that involve topics off the court or off the field. So rarely you'll ever hear about stats or scores on our platform. It will be topics like family, teammates, mental health, outside of sport hobbies. And Chris and I have been spending the last 6 weeks already traveling across the country, meeting with college athletes and capturing their photo without their jersey on. We've been capturing their photos and helping share their story in their own words. And we've already been to Duke, Oregon, Arizona State, Iowa State, and others. And we're going to be heading off on another road trip in the coming weeks. So it's, yeah, really exciting stuff, and we're just getting started.
I didn't hear Wisconsin on that list, Olivia. Is there a plan to come to UW-Madison, your alma mater, and other schools around the state?
Yes, there is. We have been to Wisconsin. I guess I look at Wisconsin as the home base. So when I'm thinking of where we're going,
Excellent. It's
usually we're leaving Madison to go somewhere else. But we do have some stories on the way with a women's hockey player at Wisconsin, and they actually just won the national championship this past Sunday.
Talking to Olivia Hancock and Chris Borland about their new project, an athlete storytelling company called Buy Us Media. Chris, you've already shared some of the stories online. One powerful one, an athlete with connections to Turkey and his reactions to the horrific earthquake there. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was a basketball player on Drake named Okai, and a story that we were introduced to recently, and a really powerful one. His family, his parents grew up in Turkey. met there in school. And actually, his folks lost some loved ones in the earthquake. And this was something that had been mentioned only briefly. I think Drake Athletics put out a video, Okai and a fellow athlete at Drake, a Turkish women's volleyball player, wanted to raise some funds and awareness. But what we were really fascinated in was, you know, this had happened, this tragedy that Okai had personal ties to, in the midst of a historic run for Drake. They won their conference tournament for the first time. They were competing in the NCAA tournament. And it was just something that he was trying to juggle in his life. And I think that's kind of the power and importance of what we want to accomplish. It's really that what athletes are experiencing personally. His was a dramatic example. We'll have another story out tomorrow on a women's basketball player from Iowa State who helped start South Sudan women's national basketball team. Just an amazing person. And she wrote about identity, trying to fit in while often sticking out, mental health, and just the reminder that she's a human first. I think she's done a lot of wonderful things in her life and can be kind of cast as a hero or a symbol for something, but just really wanted to focus on her mental health. So there's so many incredible stories. Not all are so heavy. There's some lighter and fun ones, but that's the reality of college sports. There's you know, hundreds of thousands of different experiences, and we want to kind of let fans in and see what each are like.
And Olivia, if I'm hearing this right, the goal is not we're going to find the biggest stars in the biggest sports, you know, and profile the Heisman Trophy contenders and things like that. You're trying to get it sounds like a broad cross section of the people involved in college athletics. Do I have that about right?
Yes, you are definitely correct there. Chris just mentioned two basketball players, one that's plays for a men's team and one that plays for a women's. But coming up, we have stories from cross country runners and even from a women's wrestler. Iowa has the first Power Five Conference women's wrestling team. So we will be sharing stories of tennis players, wrestlers, runners, really any sport that is in college sports. So definitely excited to be bringing a diverse array of storytellers to the table.
Chris, I wonder about generational change here. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that you were a college player, but now you're talking to athletes who really grew up in the social media world with the concept of people really presenting their own image. Are you hoping to capture some of that, I don't know, that attitude?
Yeah, I don't know if it's the attitude. You know, I graduated just 9 years ago, and in that time, so much has changed. Mm-hmm. I think young people, even if you aren't an athlete, it's so hard to grow up in the era of social media. Everything you do is observed, watched, talked about by your peers on social media. And I think that the volume is turned up on that when it comes to athletes. The recruiting process, your play on the field, anything you do off the field is kind of under a microscope. So that's come up with every athlete we've talked to. The mental health challenges associated with that have often come up as well. So a few things that we want to accomplish is, you know, humanizing these young people. I think it's easy for fans to forget that they're complex individuals that are living lives outside of their performance on and off the field. So that's one thing that we're fascinated by. And I think also providing a healthier image for young people. Our readership, our viewership will, you know, be as young as preteens and teenagers. And to see an athlete that you idolize be vulnerable, be honest, be earnest, I think there's a lot of power in that. And I think young people that read our stories, we're able to see themselves in the athletes that are sharing stories outside of the court, outside of the field.
And Olivia, as the two of you roam the land talking to athletes, are you getting a lot of enthusiasm from the college athletes you talk to, a willingness and excitement to share their stories?
Yes, we are. They've, I think, just been so energized and refreshed to hear that a platform like this exists. Chris has talked a little bit about the community that we're creating, but I think athletes have, and college athletes specifically, have often been told what to say, you know, how to say it. And now they feel really empowered and excited to share their story in their own words. These are multifaceted individuals, and to have a platform that they can share stories and experiences outside of sport, I think is a really new thing for them. And we've seen an incredible reception so far from the athletes themselves.
Chris, I could see an athlete being concerned given, as you were saying, they're under the microscope. If they say the wrong thing, it could really come back to haunt them very quickly. How do you and the athletes you talk to navigate that?
Well, we take our time. I think we've all seen athletes interviewed immediately after a big win or loss, and they might be in the locker room and still feeling those emotions and say something they regret. Olivia and my approach has been to work with athletes. They draft what they want to say. If they want feedback, we can provide it. But we're in no rush. I think one of my frustrations at times being covered as an athlete was, you know, being maybe the quote that I didn't want in was the one that was included, or, you know, how I said something maybe wasn't what I meant on video. So we're patient with athletes and let them entirely control what they want to say. And, you know, I think that's been, like Olivia said, something that's refreshing. It's, you know, athletes can really take their time and think about the story that they want to share exactly how they want to. They are under, you know, pressure. I think there's a, there's so many cliches in sports about not wanting to be a distraction or putting the team first. But what we see more and more, and I think this is close to recruiting, is that young athletes that are used to, you know, being on social media, sharing their story, want to go to a place where they can be themselves and be supported. So even with athletic departments that we've spoken with, understand the importance of the idea. And I think it's just the new media landscape in college sports. It's going to be about elevating athletes' stories and not as controlling as it's been in the past.
We'll leave it there. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rob.
And Olivia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Rob.
Olivia Hancock and Chris Borland are co-founders of a new athlete storytelling company, By Us Media. Olivia is a UW-Madison graduate. Chris played linebacker for the UW-Madison Badgers. They're with us today to talk about players using their own platforms to tell their stories instead of relying on traditional media. Up next, UW-Milwaukee sports media professor joins us for a look at the broader trend among players and what it means for the types of stories fans get to hear. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you and do you want to learn more about your favorite players? Do you follow athletes at any level on social media to get that direct contact? Do you want to hear more of their off-the-field stories? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about how we get to know our favorite athletes, why many of them are switching to their own storytelling platforms instead of relying just on traditional news media. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you follow any kind of media to hear the personal stories, the life stories of athletes at any level? If so, where do you go for that? A newspaper, a news website, a sports website, or these platforms where athletes tell their own stories? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Michael Myrer is visiting assistant professor of journalism at UW-Milwaukee, where he teaches about sports media. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Pleasure to be here.
Michael, we just heard about this By Us effort here in Wisconsin. It's not the first platform trying to help athletes go direct to people with their own stories. What do you make of this trend, if it is a trend?
Well, it certainly is a trend. I think people are interested in taking advantage of the ability to speak directly to audiences. Pro athletes have done this for a long time. Now that college athletes are sort of able to monetize their personal images, I think it's becoming a more pressing question for college athletes, because the NCAA just, you know, stopped punishing student athletes for name, image, and likeness violations, right? They can now promote products. So developing a public persona and being able to speak outside of a media apparatus, I think, is of increasing value to college athletes.
Now, journalistically, I think, okay, for a politician, you know, if I'm a politician, of course, I want to be able to speak without the media intervening, but that may not necessarily be a public good, right? You want politicians to be challenged by, you know, some kind of third party from time to time. Is there any harm if we're talking about athletes instead of politicians?
So I think for both athletes and politicians, we should understand that they are speaking from a context, right? Athletes are telling, you know, athletes have a perspective and politicians have a perspective. The fact that they can say things does not mean that we should specifically believe them, right? So, you know, a politician goes on TV, an athlete makes a public statement, right? We as an audience have the right to, subject that to our reasoned analysis and criticize it if we find their statement lacking. We love having, you know, when journalists were in control, the idea that that sort of bad ideas never got through is not, you know, that's not true, right? We're celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War, and certainly reporting failed in some cases there. Wrong information made it through, right? The presence of journalists, sadly, as I say this as a former journalist, doesn't guarantee us anything.
I think of the old days of sports with all the myth-making and, you know, kind of creating characters like Yogi Berra and Babe Ruth that were not necessarily real versions of who they are. Has traditional sports media gotten a little better, a little more authentic over the years, do you think?
I think it is. So there was a pushback in, you know, even at the time for the people who were building these people as like major symbols. If you go back and read sports journalism history, there's this divide between gee whiz and aw nut sports writers. And the gee whizers were the ones who, you know, wanted to turn athletes into symbols. But as the famous sports writer Robert Lipsight said, you know, gilding the lily is not good to the lily, right? The flower dies. Making athletes into symbols didn't actually do the athletes any favors. It is dehumanizing on some level. It has us sort of turning them into symbols that we can use rather than understanding the athlete as a fully blooded human being.
Now, I also asked them about, and I don't want to hear you talk about this, the potential minefields. Athletes do get a lot of attention. They're responsible to themselves, their team, their teammates. Does it make sense in some cases for athletes to not want to take these kind of chances and put themselves out there like this?
I mean, for any media platform, you expect that some athletes are going to get themselves into trouble, right? I remember a few years ago, Pat Connaughton of the Milwaukee Bucks got in trouble for a cameo video that he made, right? It's a sort of fan service website. So people are going to get themselves in trouble, and managing media dynamics, though, is part of college sports, right? Especially at the higher levels, especially for sports that do generate a lot of media coverage. So there are going to be minefields. This is a new avenue for college sports to have to sort of contend with.
What about those athletes who aren't in those high-profile sports and high-profile programs? Do you see this as an opportunity for the public to learn more about their lives and for them to share a little piece of themselves?
I do. I think one of the things that we have seen in just the last couple of years as athletes have started to be able to sign endorsement deals, that it's not just football players and men's basketball players getting those deals, right? Athletes from all over the sporting landscape have been able to sort of make those connections with the public. Now, there are lots of sort of elements in there that we can debate and discuss in terms of racial dynamics, gender dynamics, but ultimately, right, it's this opening up of the media landscape does enable more participants, right? For good and for ill, it enables more participants. I think in this case, that we're hearing from people beyond just the traditional men's basketball, football duality, I think is probably a positive.
Any kind of media we talk about now faces challenges on the money side of things, the changing nature of advertising in print or on TV or online or what have you. This kind of stuff is no exception. Players Tribune, who feature direct stories from athletes, not a roaring success. They've had some good stuff. This new thing by us, no guarantee of success. What do you think is going to make the difference for the survival and thriving of an athlete-centered platform like this?
I mean, it's going to be adoption, right? It's going to be people sort of coming to it. It's going to be the ability for the platform to generate conversation, to put ideas in front of people, to get them to think about these things and discuss them. But the revenue side is a challenge for everything in media, even something like this. So, you know, I wish them the best of luck, because I think it's an exciting idea, to sort of make sure that like the range of college athletes are able to speak. I covered college sports for 6 years before I went on this academic path, and there are a lot of great stories and there's not enough time to tell them. And so it's going to be great to be able to hear from other people. And so the challenge will be sort of figuring out how to manage branding, how to manage advertising, how to sort of bring in enough money to keep the platform going.
As somebody who watches this, as someone who used to report on college athletics, what kind of stories, however they're presented, would you like to see more of?
You know, I want to see more of the, I'm a sucker for the behind the scenes stuff, the challenges that athletes face on a day-to-day basis. I think that stuff is really fascinating. So just the way you manage your life, like that's what I'm interested in. But I'm also interested in this, you know, the college experience is so alienating for somebody who's not also devoting 20 hours to sports, right? You're dropping down in a new location, you're meeting new people, you're embedded in a new community, right? Like, that's not a story we hear, right? That, you know, everything is sort of rooted, you know, the media apparatus is geared around toward game coverage and describing what happened in the game, right? This understanding what the challenges are on a daily basis. Like, I think that insight is the stuff that I was always most fascinated by.
And we'll thank our guest, Michael Meyer, visiting assistant professor of journalism at UW-Milwaukee, where he teaches about sports media. He was with us today for a look at athlete-centered storytelling platforms. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, there are a lot of question marks in the economy these days. What does it all mean for you and your money? A personal finance expert joins the show with advice and answers to your questions. And you can get started right now. Is there a big question you have about how to manage your money, to invest it, thinking about mortgages and more? Email right now, ideas@WPR.org, then join the show tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Suppose you see a cat, and you want that cat to come over to you. What is the best way to communicate that notion? Turns out there's some new science behind that. A cat researcher in France put it to the test with some cats who live, and I guess work, in cafes. The experiment tried four different things. Ignore the cat, make a sound like pss, 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 but different in French, they do something different. Gesture, like, you know, a come here gesture, or gesture and make a sound. Now, sometimes I hear that cats always go to the person who doesn't want to interact with them and looks away from them. But nope, the cats in the experiment responded best to the people who made the sound and the gesture. If you got to choose, the gesture alone worked better than the sound alone. And when people totally ignored the cats, that led the cats to wag their tails more. That's not a happy thing like for dogs. That means the cats are confused at the lack of attention. Now, these are cats who like people. The study left out cats who just completely ignored people no matter what they did. There's probably a lot of cats. Interspecies communication news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, why are American women having fewer babies? A historian looks at the long and complicated relationship between womanhood and motherhood. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, anger is all around us. It's part of who we are, how we interact, and it has its place and purpose. But we aren't always great at processing and communicating our anger. And we often really need help when we're on the receiving end of someone who's angry and treating us badly as a result. Those negative, potentially explosive interactions can be one-offs with someone you'll never see again, or they could be repeated with someone who's got a consistent presence in your professional, personal, or family life. Our next guest has advice for handling these situations, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. When and how do you interact with angry people? How do you handle it? If you work at a job where the customers or clients are sometimes mad at you, how do you react to that? Have you had a long-term family situation with anger that you found some way to resolve? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ryan Martin is professor of psychology at UW Green Bay and author of the book Why We Get Mad. His new book is called How to Deal with Angry People, 10 Strategies for Facing Anger at Home, at Work, and in the Street. Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Now, we talked about your last book, Why We Get Mad, and that was meant as an aid for dealing with our own anger. This is for dealing with the anger of others. What led you to write this book?
Yeah, it actually started with a request from a friend who said she was dealing with other people's anger and was wondering if I could write. It started as a blog post a long time ago for Psychology Today. Said, would you take some time and give me some strategies? And then about 2 years ago, I turned that same blog post into a TikTok series, and it got a lot of interest, and a lot of people reached out and told me that they needed this kind of help. And so it felt like a good approach for my next book.
Before we get into strategies for dealing with angry people, you make an important distinction right up front between, you know, someone who's angry and something that might be a chronically abusive relationship where someone might use displays of anger as an instrument of control. This is a different situation than the anger we're mostly going to talk about here, right?
Yeah, I really want to make clear right out of the gate that this book is not for people who are in an abusive relationship. It's not for people who are being harmed by someone, either physically or emotionally. That's not what this book is for. It's for people who experience, either through their job or because of someone they know, they live with or experience someone else who is angry. And it's important to note, too, that sometimes the angry people we deal with day in and day out aren't necessarily angry with us, right? They might be angry at the world. They might be angry often, and you're present for that anger, but it isn't necessarily directed at you in a way that is harmful or hostile.
Now, let's talk a little bit about anger as an emotional state. I'm angry in the moment, compared with anger as a personality trait. That so-and-so is an angry person.
Yeah, like any emotion, anger is something that everybody feels. We feel it a couple of times a week to a couple of times a day. But at the same time, there are these individual differences with regard to how often or how intensely we experience anger. And some people are angrier than others. And for those people who are angrier than others, who tend to get angry more often, who get angrier than people typically do, or even who express that anger in really maladaptive ways, we tend to think of them as having being what we call high on trait anger, meaning that they have more of an angry personality trait. And so there are people out there who may know a person who's high in trait anger, and then this book is a good fit for them and offers some strategies there. There are also people, though, who, because of the type of job they have, usually service providers, who will tell you that they just work with they encounter a lot of people who are high in state anger, because of the nature of the job.
Now, with different types of communication with angry people, you have a lot of suggestions that might work for any kinds of those interactions. The first one is really interesting. When we're dealing with someone who's angry, either in the moment or chronically, the notion that we want to work out what we really want out of this. How can we do that? How can we figure out, what do I want to come from my interactions with this angry person? It sounds easier said than done in some ways.
Yeah, I think it often is. And that's why it's important to sort of step back and focus on that. When you're in an interaction with an angry person, you may find yourself wanting to do some things that aren't actually best for you or best for that interaction. And so what I encourage people to do is to think about their goals and think about their desired outcome. And what I mean is, there are times where maybe you're confronted by someone, maybe someone is angry with you, and what you decide you want to do is get back at them in some way or lash out back at them. And when we're in this kind of emotional situation, we bring our own emotions to the table as well. And so when someone's angry at me, I might respond with my own anger. I might respond with some sadness. I might respond with some fear or guilt or something else. And so in that moment, sometimes we lose sight of what is best for us. And this first strategy is really about saying, okay, what is best for me? What is best to get out of this situation in a healthy, positive way? And it might be different than sort of what my instincts are telling me in the moment.
Talking to Ryan Martin, professor of psychology at UW Green Bay, author of the new book, How to Deal with Angry People, 10 Strategies for Facing Anger at Home, at Work, and in the Street. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your advice, maybe your strategies for dealing with difficult people, say on the job, if you encounter a lot of anger in your line of work. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Pat is with us in Madison. Pat, hi.
Hi there. So I stayed angry for a long time in my life. I grew up with two alcoholic parents and, you know, very dysfunctional. And I learned that anger was a big cover up for me for the sadness that I was dealing with. And I used to have these fits of rage. You know, they called me this angry person. And you know, I think the best strategy for me was to have friends and everybody just say, you know, what's really going on? You know, instead of saying, calm down, you know, if they just said, hey, you know, what's going on? And, you know, when I learned through going to Al-Anon to deal with the alcoholic parents, I found out that, you know, it was really just this big cover-up. And I just needed people around me to just get me to calm down, you know.
Pat, thank you so much for sharing that story. And, Ryan, that takes me right toward one of your steps that Pat's friends, it sounds like they understood this, understand anger from the other person's perspective. Could you talk about that, Ryan, and how it fits into Pat's story?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think one thing I'd note about that story is that there are a lot of people out there who point to anger as a quote-unquote secondary emotion, meaning it stems from other feeling states like sadness or hurt or things like that. And that is absolutely true some of the time. And it certainly sounds like it was true this time. Sometimes anger can be a primary emotion, and sometimes it can really stem from other things. In fact, there was recent research that just came out that really found a link between those aversive childhood experiences, like he was describing, and adulthood anger, saying the more traumatic the childhood, essentially, the more likely you were to be experience anger in adulthood. Now, I think that one of the things that I think is really important is for people to be able to do what I call diagramming an angry incident from another person's perspective. And what I really mean there is think about what is causing that anger, but try to think about it in a really holistic way. So bring into it, you know, the ways in which they might be interpreting some of these, what's happening to them, some of the, when you know those childhood experiences, when you can think about how emotions were modeled for the person, which sometimes we can't do, but sometimes we can. Thinking about even the mood state they're in at the time of the provocation. Are they under a lot of stress? Are they exhausted? And so on. All of those, they do two things for us. One, it's about empathy. It's about learning to kind of see things from the other person's perspective, develop a little bit of understanding as to what they're dealing with and what they're going through. But it also might tell you where to intervene. And it might give you a sense for, okay, so now that I understand the cause fully and completely, instead of, as the caller mentioned, instead of just telling the person to relax, I can potentially, again, depending on my relationship with the person, mm-hmm. dig into some of those causes. I can say, hey, what's really going on? And we can unpack some of that.
Pat, thanks a lot for that call. We are talking to UW Green Bay professor of psychology, Ryan Martin, about his new book. It's called How to Deal with Angry People. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about how to deal with angry people? Do you have an anecdote, a story to share about a time when you or someone you interacted with was the angry party, how the situation played out, escalated, or was resolved in a better way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Ryan Martin, professor of psychology at UW-Green Bay, and we're talking about his new book. It's called How to Deal with Angry People, 10 Strategies for Facing Anger at Home, at Work, and in the Street. You can join in with your questions, your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Beth is with us in Heartland. Beth, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Beth?
So one thing that I'm noticing, I am in a public education, and the thing that I see is that when I'm angry with somebody for, like, the experience today was somebody not holding up the end of their job, not doing their job, actually. And what I found was that I could be angry at the person who didn't follow through, and yet I needed to separate my feelings toward the person who didn't do their job and yet be really action oriented toward putting the student first and, like, making sure that the student is focused on first and taking an action step to make sure the student's needs are met versus being angry at the person for not doing their job.
Okay, Beth, I got to ask, this sounds great. Is that easy for you to do? Because I think I would have a hard time, you know, staying that calm and taking my feelings out of it.
Well, and I think that it's important for us to take a little space and mentally say, okay, first we're going to deal with, like, for our situation today, that there wasn't a process in place for this to happen. And so I can say, like, let's think about a process first so that it doesn't happen again. Because I have to take my feelings out of it. But there's a little voice inside my head that says, this is not about you, Beth. This is about making sure that we have a process so this doesn't happen again.
Fantastic.
And I feel like people are able to take that because then they don't get attacked, right? And we put the kids first.
Beth, thanks so much for sharing that. Ryan, sounds like Beth is a pro. And again, she's talking, I think, right out of your book here.
Yeah, I mean, there is an art and a skill to being able to stay calm in those situations and ultimately redirect that and channel that for anger or whatever emotion you're feeling into something sort of positive and pro-social. I'm a big advocate for trying to solve problems when you are feeling anything. I mean, I think at a very, very basic level, one of the things our emotions are telling us is that we've got some sort of problem. And so a way of dealing with that is to try and solve whatever that problem is. Of course, finding ways to stay calm and keep your cool is it's one of the things I talk about in the book, and it is a real it's a real art that takes a lot of practice and time.
Beth, thanks a lot for that call. Let's dig into that, Ryan. Somebody's mad at us. They're yelling at us. The last thing I probably feel then is calm and collected. How do I get there?
Yeah, so this is such a challenge, and I can't say that there's a simple way to do it. A couple things I advocate. One is to actually take some time to reflect back on experiences after the fact, to do a little bit of practicing in your head. I liken it to how athletes oftentimes watch game tape. You know, if you think through this interaction and maybe ask yourself, where could I have done things differently? Or where could I have handled this situation a little differently? Not in a way that is self-critical, which I think people often do, but in a way that is really reflective and preparing for future experiences. One of our goals has to be to find that moment to pause and to kind of hit that pause button and learn to relax in the moment. That comes through practice. That comes through sort of intentional activity and reflection.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us now in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I guess I got two parts to it. One is my experience in my adult life is with men. Anger very often manifests with aggression and threats, physical threats. And the other part that I've heard about is that at least for older men, I guess senior, older than 60, men that can suffer from depression, that the depression can manifest as anger.
Interesting, Tom. Thanks for those questions. Let's start with the first one. When anger ends up intentionally or unintentionally being a threatening, aggressive display, Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's it is undeniable that men are more likely to express their anger outwardly than women are. Not necessarily through aggression, but sometimes through aggression. So outward expressions of anger can include also just yelling and swearing and screaming and things like that, but not necessarily with the intent to harm. When there is that intent to harm, one of the things I talk about is you really need to disengage in those moments and prioritize safety above and beyond all else. As for the piece about depression, I think that's one of the things that's really interesting, and I suspect in many ways the caller is right, and I also think that there's probably some generational differences that might be present there, in the sense that, you know, oftentimes men have been taught historically not to express particular feelings like sadness or fear. And so I do think there is a tendency for some of those feelings to come out in other ways. And I think that's particularly true of older generations that have, where that there wasn't really as much modeling of some of those other emotional expressions.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Ryan Martin about his book, How to Deal with Angry People. Ryan, I want to conjure up a scenario here. We had an airline fiasco not that long ago where gate attendants were dealing with lots and lots of angry people who couldn't get where they were going. The gate attendants had really nothing to offer them, thanks to their company, to help them out with it. In that situation, somebody's angry at you because of something that's not your fault, and you really have nothing to solve their problem with. How could you deal with that kind of anger with your customers?
Yeah, I think a lot of times dealing with that sort of frustration is, I mean, obviously, when we can solve their problem, we should, especially if we're the ones who are in part responsible for it. But I think that sometimes what people actually really want is to feel heard. And so taking moments to listen, feel that sort of, to sort of empathize with them, and to do what we can is really, really important. Again, it doesn't mean tolerating abuse. It doesn't mean tolerating a real intense hostility, but it means sort of hearing and giving them that space to share that frustration.
And then a much more personal setting, and you write a lot about this in the book, where someone might have a family member and they feel that family member, they like them for the most part, love them probably, but anger, at least periodically, chronically, gets in the way. What are some strategies for dealing with that kind of long-term anger within your own family?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's really tough, you hear a lot from people online that I've talked to say, you know what, if I'm surrounded by someone who's angry, I just want to disengage and cut them loose and they're toxic and do away with them. And one of the things I found in talking to people is that that isn't really, for many people, realistic, and it isn't necessarily what they want to do. They want to have a relationship with that person, and they feel compelled because that person is sort of entangled in their life in all sorts of ways, through their siblings or through their kids or their other parents or whatever. And so they really want to have some sort of relationship with them, or feel like they need to have that relationship with them. I think there is the possibility of sort of disengaging in some ways, meaning maybe you minimize contact or you keep contact in only in certain ways. You find ways to effectively communicate with them that might be different than some traditional ways. So maybe you text them more frequently instead of actually having a face-to-face conversation, things like that, to try and engage. I also think there are times where, and plenty of people that I talked to advocated the just direct conversation, saying, you know, this is what I'm seeing, this is what I'm concerned about, and I think we need to sort of reframe how we interact moving forward.
And briefly, Ryan, I want to take this back to your first book now. How can we diagnose if we are the person who's putting other people in this situation in the first place? How do we diagnose our own problem anger, just briefly?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. One is doing your part to listen to what people are telling you. And so if people are giving you that information that your anger is distressing to them, I think you got to hear that and take it to heart, especially if they're people you're close to. I tend to focus on the consequences, though. Think about the way, there's nothing unhealthy about anger on its own, but think about the ways that your anger might be causing relationship distress, might be causing you some emotional distress, might be leading to other sorts of problems. Pay attention to that sort of thing, and it'll give you a pretty good clue.
Ryan, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
You bet. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Ryan Martin, professor of psychology at UW Green Bay. We talked to him about his new book. It's called How to Deal with Angry People, 10 Strategies for Facing Anger at Home, at Work, and in the Street. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, gun violence numbers are very different from one region of the United States to another. And a guest tells us it may have a lot to do with the culture and history unique to those regions. And a copyright lawsuit targeting songwriter and performer Ed Sheeran was rejected. A lot was riding on that case for the music of the future. Find out what's at stake and what it means to make original music. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, online paywalls for news sites can create an information gap between those who can afford to pay for news and those who can't. A Wisconsin journalism expert joins the show to look at possible solutions. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.